when we use that term, primary care physicians, we're talking about family practice?
Well, actually, yes, you are talking family practice, but the federal definition of primary care includes family medicine, general pediatrics, general internal medicine, OBGYN for women's health, mm-hmm. And sometimes they even include emergency medicine in there. So that spectrum is all primary care to do that.
And when we talk about a shortage of primary care physicians, it certainly seems like this has been something we've been feeling for a while now. How long have we seen this shortage?
There was a Blue Ribbon panel commissioned by the state of Michigan in the early 2000s, and it included members from Wayne State, University of Michigan, Michigan State, and many of the other people in the state. And at that time, back in the early 2000s, the Blue Ribbon panel identified that Michigan was going to face a shortage of primary care providers by about 4,000 by the year 2020. One of those issues was we looked at that number and we thought it was going. So my college at that time was about 200 students a year. We're at 315 a year.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the largest medical school in the state because we raised our class size to try to look at that coming down. Because in medical education, you can't just do it one year and have it come out the next. It's about a seven-year process.
Right.
So we graduate about 315. About 50-60% of my students still go into primary care. That's the highest, I believe, of any of the medical schools in the state of Michigan. And the College of Osteopathic Medicine at Michigan State is ranked number 9 in the entire nation, U.S. News & World Report, for primary care of all medical schools.
Well, when we look at the fact that the Blue Ribbon panel, you know, a decade ago said we were going to see a 4,000 primary care physician shortage, that was before the Affordable Care Act. How has that impacted things?
Yeah, that's why I made that point,
yes,
because everybody jumps on the fact that Affordable Care Act has got this and this. Really, we knew the shortage was there. The Affordable Care Act now says maybe we're going to be about 5,000 or 6,000 physicians short in primary care, but it really hasn't anything to do with the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with people go into non-primary care. A friend of mine once said they go into what we call specialist care, but he uses the term partialist care. And he said they go into it because they want to control their life. I mean, in primary care, you see everything that comes through the door all the time, and it can be very rewarding, but it is it's sometimes a lot harder to do than if you are a dermatologist or you are a orthopedic surgeon. You know pretty much what you're going to see every day, and you train for that. Family medicine may see headache one patient. They may see somebody with an ovarian cyst the next patient. You got this, and that's all great, and I find that very enthusiastic, but bottom line is, a 65-hour work week for a primary care doc, and he's going to make one half of what a cardiologist makes, kind of drives that train the other direction. And we're trying to do everything we can to combat that issue.
I guess knowing with the Affordable Care Act we're actually going to have more patients in the system means there's going to be more people that you're going to look to try to get into that primary care to keep them healthy before they do need that specialist.
Yeah, well, technically, you know, it's an interesting thing. Everybody says we're going to get more patients in, but realistically, the good thing about the United States system is that even if somebody didn't have health insurance before, they were always seen. If they really had a medical problem, they showed up in the emergency rooms and whatever.
Yeah.
So although we're going to get more people into the primary care offices now earlier, it's really those patients have always been in the system one way or the other, or a majority of those
mm-hmm.
patients have been in the system. The problem we're going to have is this, and it really is primary care in Detroit, Grand Rapids, Lansing, Ann Arbor, is really not a problem finding a doctor because they're here and they're there. When you go north of Clare, Michigan, it gets very difficult because right now there's a distribution problem. And the biggest problem is you can have 20 family physicians in Detroit, but you have 2 in the Upper Peninsula. How do we make that thing different? And that's very difficult because we don't just assign people to work in a location. They have to want to go there. What my school is trying to do is we look at, I'm a big believer, if you want somebody to practice in the Upper Peninsula, you need to be able to admit them from the Upper Peninsula.
Got it.
Because if you've never lived there, It's very difficult for somebody that's lived in Dearborn, Detroit, to say, gee, I'm going to send you to Curtis Lake, Michigan. They'll go up there for a week vacation, but to live there through the winter every year requires somebody that comes from that area to know what small-town medicine's like, and we try to look at that issue.
When you talk about training to be a primary care doctor, how long is it? What's the typical residency? Let's say I want to be a general internist.
A general internist would be you go through medical school 4 years, and then you would do a 3-year residency in after you graduate from medical school.
But then let's say contrast that to being a neurosurgeon. You're looking at much longer residencies. You're looking at fellowships. And couldn't one argue that the cost of that specialist training is actually greater to a student than the primary care because you're out earning 7 years after you enter medical school?
Yeah, except that the cost of the medical student really is in the first 4 years. They pay tuition the first 4 years. When they become a resident in whether they're medicine or surgery or whatever, they're getting paid at least a salary during their residency program. So they're not borrowing money to work in their residency. They're being paid by the system to do that. So, yes, a neurosurgeon would come out of medical school. He would do a first-year, what we used to call an internship. Mm-hmm. Now that's a first-year residency. And then it'd probably be a 4 years of a neurosurgical residency. And then if he wanted to subspecialize, he may go into a fellowship. So you're talking a boarded neurosurgeon could be done in probably 4 or 5 years after medical school. Family physician could be done in 3. General internist done in 3 after medical school. But if you want to be a cardiologist, it's 6.
It's a long time before they can start working off those med school debts.
Well, that, yeah, because they're not being paid a whole lot
sure.
as an intern or resident. And although they can live, most of these people by now are now in their 30s. They usually have a family. They've got children. They have the same problems we all have. How do I pay for my car? My wife wants a house. My wife wants to eat something besides macaroni and cheese.
Sure enough.
In medical school, I lived a year on essentially Kraft macaroni and cheese and turkey legs because the turkey legs were 19 cents a pound.
Boy.
I know now I no longer eat macaroni and cheese or turkey legs.
Those days are behind you.
Those days are behind.
We're speaking with Dr. William Strample, who is Dean of the College of Osteopathic Medicine at Michigan State University, as we look at Michigan health system coping with a dearth of doctors. We have a physician shortage. And so from where you sit as the dean of a school that is training osteopathic physicians, clearly you're doing a good job getting more than half of your students to go into primary care. But what else can be done in general in medical education to lure more students into primary care? Can you incentivize them to make that choice?
Yeah, and I think that's the real issue. Cost of medical education is tremendous. I mean, the average student we have graduates probably with $180,000, $200,000 debt. And the reason it is because you cannot work even part-time while you're in medical school. It is too rigorous. It's 4 years of your life that you are absolutely committed to. So you're building this debt for tuition and to live on and whatever. So what happens when you're a first-year, second-year medical student, you're running through with everybody else, and you're looking at, let's say you're looking at family medicine.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at family medicine, and if you go out and you're 5 years out and you're in practice and you're doing this, we know right now the average income in Michigan for a family physician runs about $160,000 to $180,000 a year gross. And that's working a 65-hour work week and whatever. And many of us are very happy when we do that. Not a problem at all. Okay.
Right.
And if you're used to looking at a job where you're making $60,000, you think, well, God, that's great money. But then you sit next to a guy that is basically going out and he's going to be an orthopedic surgeon, and roughly that same guy goes through the same 4 years of medical school. He goes to an orthopedic residency, and suddenly he gets out, and in 5 years, he's making about $450,000 a year.
Ooh.
If I'm a sophomore in medical school and I have the choice where I could make the decision to go either way, where would I go?
Absolutely.
Because paying off your student loan making $450,000 a year is a lot faster proposition than making $160,000 because it's not just $100,000. Remember, you're now married, you got a family, you got housing, you got cars. So it's not all liquid income. You can just say, gee, you can pay that debt off. So most of the people in primary care have about a 10-year window from the time they graduate from their residency to pay off their student debt. That's like buying a house without getting a house. Wow. In orthopedics, if you did the same thing, you might have a four-year window to pay off your student debt and begin to think about how am I going to put money away for retirement and whatever. That is the disincentive on the primary care side. What we're trying to do in some areas of Michigan, underrepresented, underserved, some of the counties come in with a partnership where they will support paying off some of the student debt if the person stays in their county for 4 years or 5 years. And I see more and more of those. And the state of Michigan contributes to some of that. They're trying through the Center for Rural Health and some of these to match up providers in these underserved areas. And that attracts a lot of people
yes.
that say, gee, that I can live here. I'm getting the extra money to help pay my student loan. And that brings a person to a small town somewhere that doesn't have a doctor. Those are the kind of programs that probably need to be expanded to do that.
Do we also need to do what you've done at the Michigan State School of Osteopathic Medicine? You enlarged your class size.
All the school. I think Jim Wallencroft at Ann Arbor has enlarged his class. I think Wayne State has done that, and I know my sister college at Michigan State has raised a class. The problem for the end result is not just the number of medical students in the, it's the number of residency programs in postgraduate education. And that number was capped by the federal government in 1994. And every intern and resident in every hospital in Michigan is supplied by that federal cap. If they raise the number of residency training slots in primary care, you'd produce more primary care providers. And that's an issue at the federal level, not the state level, to do that.
Big challenges as we look ahead to our shortage of physicians in Michigan, and great insights from Dr. William Strample, who is Dean of the College of Osteopathic Medicine at Michigan State University. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, Dr. Strample. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Cindy. I appreciate it.